Hello and welcome to the live stream live. I'm your host, Joshua Schubart, and I hope you're doing incredibly well on this lovely New York Tuesday evening. I have a great show for you tonight. We have a wonderful guest. Puya Moasani is here with us. She's an incredible actor, activist, LGBTQIA plus consultant, and just an overall wonderful person who is killing it right now. You have seen her on TV, you've seen her in movies, and she's about to make her Broadway debut. Before we start, here's a word from our sponsor that I wrote myself. So the sponsor of the live stream live is Lucas Roasting Company LLC. They are an incredible company that makes the most wonderful coffee. And I wrote this copy myself and heard it for the first time last week, but here we go again. Nestled in the heart of Wolfboro, New Hampshire is Lucas Roasting Company, dedicated to bringing you finely crafted roasts and coffee blends. A small family business that views coffee as not only a work of art, but as a way to showcase the origin and give back to the farmers. This small batch award-winning coffee is roasted to order and shipped within days to maximize flavor and aroma. And I have personally been drinking this coffee for years, and I am so happy to have them as a partner on the show. It's pretty much the only thing that me and my wife drink anymore when it comes to coffee, and they gave us this awesome promo code. The live stream live gives you 15% off your first order. Go there. The website is linked in all of the descriptions, or it's in all of my Instagram profiles. Lucas Roasting Company, thank you so much. All right. So what have I been up to this week? Well, it is the end of the season, I suppose, for TV and film. We are coming quickly up to hiatus. And for those of you that don't know what that means, it means that the TV and film industry mostly goes to sleep from December 20th to about January 6th. So we all get a nice break from auditioning and things of that nature. So I've been doing a lot of end of the year emailing, sending out a lot of heartfelt thank yous, and reviewing what I can do better for next year when it comes to audition tracking and just being an overall better artist and business person. I did go to a live event this weekend. I went to the WWE's Saturday Night main event with my wife out here on Long Island, and I have to say it was a fun and wacky, crazy time, just like you would expect with the world of professional wrestling. And we had a great time. My wife is 8.5 months pregnant, so we had a very subdued, non-alcoholic time, but it was a lot of fun. I had a few beers, we watched people do a lot of fun stunts, and we yelled, and we got home at a reasonable hour and went to sleep, because we old now. Here is my show mug for today. It is a beer stein with a clover on it to, because I'm Irish AF, that's what I'm drinking out of today. I'm still watching Arcane. I'm watching it slowly because it's so good. It's an animated show. If you don't know what it is, it's on Netflix, and you should watch this animated show called Arcane. It is brutally heart-wrenching and incredibly good drama. And if you don't know, the Animation Guild has been on strike for a long time, and they just got a really terrible contract back that they're trying to get ratified. But most of the membership is saying no, because the base pay will get them paid less than a non-union animation writer. And these folks create some of the most compelling and amazing work, and they don't get compensated properly because it's animation, because it's not like normal television and movies. They should be. They create some of the most compelling work that I've ever seen, or that you've ever seen, since you've been able to watch TV, I'm sure. And it's also why SAG-AFTRA is currently on strike against the video game companies. It's kind of for the same reason, proper compensation and things of that nature. Puya has been in a bunch of games that I've played and that I'm a big fan of. So it's very cool to be able to ask people that you respect and that you've known for a very long, long time. Puya and I have known each other for nearly a decade, maybe over a decade. And we have been working in the industry in our own special magical ways, but we did intersect in the beginning, right in the beginning. And I can't wait to talk about that. But like I said, I'm about to bring her on. Puya's been on Law & Order SVU, Madam Secretary. She will be in the new season of The Walking Dead, Ted City in 2025. She was in Horizon Forbidden West, which is an incredible game that I love. And she was recently, I mean, she was in Destiny 2, which is another amazing game that I love. So anyway, without further ado, here is my friend Puya. Hello.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hi. Hello to everyone. Oh, as usual, you can leave comments. We are live on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook Live. I will field them and speak to you about them as long as they're appropriate. If they're weird, I'm going to ignore you and probably make fun of you later. But I've got, what's your favorite WWE wrestler? So of all time, it's got to be Bret the Hitman Hart. Currently, I really am really liking Jey Uso a ton. Anyway, hi, Puya. Do you like the WWE?
I don't know much about WWE. I was going to lie and say sure, but I'm like, if there was a second question to that, I couldn't follow up. So I just came out. I'm like, I don't know anything about it.
So my wife and I both got really into it at separate times in our life. Me when I was a kid, and then she when she was in college, and then we've kind of like reconnected on it in the past couple of years, and it's been a really cool thing for the both of us. So
yeah. If it brings you joy, darling, that's all that matters.
I know, but it feels kind of dumb, but it's also just great fun. So I absolutely agree.
If it's dumb to somebody else, who cares, so long as you and your wife enjoy it together.
I agree. So we really kind of first met doing sketch comedy for Just Saying Productions, which was this YouTube, it's a deep cut, that's way back. It was a sketch comedy YouTube show where you can still go and watch them all. Like, I think we got like 28 of them or something. And you were in one, and we met on set there. And I remember that you were so kind and effervescent and just a really genuine person to be around. And you made me feel very, very comfortable. And I really appreciated that.
You're very kind. Thank you.
Sure. And then we continued our in meeting each other in various acting classes and things of that nature. And I got to know you a little bit more. Like, for example, I didn't know that you were trans until you told me like a few years later. And that's a problem that I have. It's not a problem. It's just if whatever people tell me they are, I believe them and just move forward.
It was about, yeah, I mean, like when I publicly came out, and you know, it's like I've talked about why I didn't come out before then, and I came out at that time and publicly. And for the most part, I think people, no, I think everybody looked at me slightly differently. Now I think most people were like, oh my God, she's not just this skinny, snooty Upper East Side person. And like, you know, things have happened. And then there were some people who distanced themselves from me. And, but you know, it's, as I get older and I look back on it, I think everything that I've done that I'm grateful for is like, I have peeled myself like an onion. Is why should I hide? If I am fully myself, how does that affect me, my career, my psyche, my soul, and all of that? So
completely agree.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, my whole, I mean, everybody's life is a journey, but my life is very, has been very soap operatic in its sequence of events.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand, you had to basically flee from where you were from because of who you are, right?
Flee might be not the correct term, and I will say that it's part of it is, while I have problems with the Iranian government and how I as a queer person was treated, I don't want to feed into this thing of like, you know, Iran bad, everywhere else in the world good.
No, sure. Yeah, that wasn't right.
Yes. I mean, it was, no, this is more like, you know, I always, because yes, I am a queer activist and I'm also a women's rights activist, and we've all seen the woman life freedom movement over the last 2 years, but the only reason I want to be specific is because there were people who literally fled because either the family wanted to kill them or somebody was actually after them. In my case, while my parents weren't supportive originally, and it was because they didn't have information, they didn't have support, they didn't have a community that they felt that they could kind of like disclose that they had a trans child, they didn't know how to support me.
Sure.
Which then pushed me into isolation, and out of that came self-harm, self-destructive behavior, getting arrested, getting assaulted. And it was that point that then especially my mom came to this realization of, if we don't do something for our teenage child, this child isn't going to live much longer.
Sure.
And I always, yet like, there was like this one moment of my mom coming home, finding me in bed with a knife, having cut my arm open in a pool of blood. And that was kind of like the moment of, we have to do something. And so now I'm about the age that she was when she faced that. So whatever I do, whatever platform I get that I talk about my experience or supporting parents so they can support their queer children, is because I think it was very cruel that my parents had to be placed in this extremely difficult situation of having to choose between the world they knew, including, you know, people they work with, their neighbors, their friends, their family members, and their trans child, and they had to pick that. And it was very difficult, and they were put in this very hard situation. And, you know, here we are. Because
here we are.
Yeah, you know, it's a combination of sass, determination, luck, angels, divine intervention, whatever
you want to call it. I mean, it's largely you. Like, I will say that, like, knowing you and knowing you've told me over and over again that where you are now is where you said you would be when I first started meeting you. So and me too. So like, it's largely a, you know, you put your mind to it and you work out how to get there. And that's not being braggadocious. That's like, that's just work. You do the work, and yes, there is a good bit of luck involved, but there is creating your own too.
I think it's the same thing that young actors now is you have to believe that you can do it. And then from that belief comes resilience and determination. And then that allows you to figure out what the steps are. But first, you have to almost be possessed by this idea that I can and I will. And, you know, going back to my teens or even before that, it was just, I always had this clear idea of me, which looking back, I'm like, I had no idea how I thought that any of that was possible.
Sure. Yeah.
Other than just determination, faith in myself, or just combination of courage and insanity, you know, how much of one, how much of the other one. But I think what has allowed me to get here as a person is also what has allowed me to get here as an actor.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm getting a bunch of really interesting comments from a viewer from India, who is saying that they remember when the news came out of Iran about mandatory forced hijab wearing, and that many Persians live in India, and they also I guess play sports, whatever. But saying that I ran as I ran, and I don't know if. Like you were trying to say that Iran isn't just Iran and that's not the way that it is. Like there's a beautiful culture there, no?
Well, I mean, it's an old culture, and old cultures have beauty. What people talk about in the West is the Iranian government.
Sure.
But as two Americans, we can say that the government of a country does not necessarily represent its people.
Oh,
that we can agree on.
Yeah.
So if that's true here, then it can be true anywhere.
Sure.
I heard somebody a couple of days ago saying something, you know, whatever was happening in Iran, and Iran was modernizing, and industry was growing, and then the revolution happened and it became a dictatorship. That is not true. That is not true. It was a dictatorship beforehand. It was just a westernized dictatorship. It wasn't a theocracy, but it was still a dictatorship, which is why the revolution happened, among many other reasons, which we're not going to, we don't have enough time to get into that. But the mandatory hijab is one of the first things that the Islamic Republic implemented right after the revolution. And that was a moment where a lot of people, a lot of intellectuals who were part of the revolution, they suddenly had this moment of like, oh, okay, what just happened?
Right.
And it's become more strict, less strict through the years, depending on what else was going on. You know, there was 8 years of war, so there were bigger problems that the government focused on than just, you know, annoying people with bad hijab. The thing the last few years has become very apparent, it's a government that has basically placed its whole identity on something very specific. And the mandatory hijab, and it's not just the mandatory hijab, a mandatory behavior that tries to replicate a particular way of living that goes back 1400 years to the early days of Islam, you know, kind of trying to recapture the purity, almost like Christian nationalists in United States trying to basically take all the rights that different groups have gained over the last 100 and something years, and they try to take it back to whatever the good old days were.
Yeah.
So that's the Islamic Republic. Now, I've said it, I'm like, when people ask me, they're like, oh, queer rights really bad. I believe no one truly has freedom in Iran, whether it's men, women, queer people, whatever. It's just that then within that, you have less rights than somebody else in that world, because it's a theocracy. It's in this world that there is absolute rule and everybody follows, and there's no room for question. which I guess shows you what a crazy kid I must have been, that 40 years ago, I'm like, well, I'm different, but that's fine. And then the world around me is like, no, that's not fine. And I would look at them. I mean, now I look at them. People tell me, you're so brave. I'm like, no, I'm in New York now. I don't know how brave I am now. 40 years ago, 30 years ago, when I cannot hide who I am, that's a certain bravery that now I look at it. I'm like, I don't know how you had that, but good for you.
Right. I mean, this is a really great comment from you, YouTube, and that's absolutely right. I mean, they want to take things back to the good old days, but for who, right? Like, it's for a very specific person or group of people. It's never for the greater good.
It's not inclusive. Everybody that says good old days, that means for particular people. And if you just look at it, we've become a more inclusive world.
Yes.
I'll give you the stupidest example. Now people can be left-handed. And right. Nobody thinks it's a sign of the devil.
Right, right. Yeah, they used to correct you. They would make you write with your right hand. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
The good old days.
Boo. So when did you discover that you wanted to do this work, like be an actor? Was it in Iran or when you came here?
I think I always wanted to be, even when I was in Iran. But, you know, I came from a middle-class family. My mom was a teacher. My dad was an accountant. And they're like, no, like, you know, people like us, we don't do that. Also, the excuse was always, but you're so smart. You're so good at school. People who go to performing arts high school, it's like there's something wrong with them. Oh, like they can't do anything else.
Oh, I see.
So I went to maths and physics high school because, you know, I was really good at math. And then, you know, my life was kind of like imploding. I was having depression. I was being bullied at school. I barely survived the final year at school. But I was always enamored. And I always tell people, I'm like, I grew up during the Iran-Iraq war. And I just remember it being a very bleak time, except when we would put a VHS tape. You youngsters, there was a time we had videotapes.
Yeah, we had to, and we had to like rewind them.
Rewind it.
Yeah.
And I remember this like huge VCR, probably weighed as much as I did as a child. And you put this thing, and then you were transferred somewhere else. Mm. You know, people were beautiful. They were joyous. And not to say all of that was real, but escapism also has value, especially when your life other than that, you know, I mean, for a child who already felt isolated because I knew that there was something about me that was different from everybody else. So movies became my best friend because I could watch them and I could get lost in them. And that connected to when my grandmother used to tell me stories. So this idea of stories and the power that they have.
Yeah, and stories are so powerful.
They're really taking you somewhere else and helping you go through experiences. And then you turn it off and you're back to your old life. And there was something just so beguiling about that. And then we ended up in the US. This would be 1997. I got accepted at FIT, Fashion Institute of Technology, in New York City. And my first entree into the world of performance was there was this extracurricular group at FIT that was the theater ensemble. So I joined that and I started doing improv. And then I started doing background work. At that time, Sex and the City was shooting. I think there was another show called either Now and Again or Now and Then. I was doing background work. There was a film with Sandra Bullock. But what brought that period to an end was that on the set of Sex and the City, I was doing background work, and we were in the green room between takes, and some guy basically outed me.
Oh, no. Okay.
Someone I didn't know, I had never spoken to before, and like I'm sitting across the room, you know, we're all sitting doing our things, I'm not even talking to, and then he's looking at me with a smirk, and then he very loudly across the room, so he doesn't come and sit next to me to ask this. This was very much to out me, to put me in my place, or whatever was the intention. He's like, so are you on hormones or what? Oh. And I'm looking at him like, I mean, I knew what he meant, but I was just playing dumb for all the gold in the world. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And
was it at that point, was it super important to pass? Like,
oh, absolutely. I wrote an article a few years ago, The Privilege of Passing.
Yeah.
It meant, first of all, you could actually get jobs because there were no, like, nowhere in the specifications for background people, like men and women. They were not interested in any weirdos.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
They wanted, no, it was like, this is 2000, maybe 2001, but around that time. No. There was no room for standing out, or at least in the world that I was, which I wanted to get work. I wanted to be able to walk down the street without getting harassed, without getting catcalled or getting assaulted. You know, I had a friend of mine who was killed in New York City because like her date found out that she was trans.
And here's the thing, Buya, like, people don't really truly understand how it was, and even how it is now for trans folks. It was highly dangerous. You were constantly hiding. You were trying to hide from everybody. There are many people, especially now with the current state of how things are going politically, that are going back in their receding. And like in my town, there was a trans kid in the high school that was being viciously bullied. And I remember I was confused. And a lot of people that look like me are very confused all the time, and they don't understand that there is a fucking problem. Like, I don't know how else to put that trans people need to be protected, and now more than ever.
I think it's something as simple as everyone in society should be protected. What is happening now is this idea that trans people are being put in a position that's very clearly, it's being said that trans people have less rights than other people. Because we say, oh, a bathroom issue? Well, these people should feel safe. But is anybody in any of this saying trans people should feel safe? The problems that are being presented, and then this legislation that's being put forward, is like a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. I was watching a podcast last week, and somebody said many of the states that have implemented laws banning the participation of trans people. And when they say trans people, they don't mean trans people in general. They specifically mean trans women and trans girls. This is also the fact that when people say trans, trans is an adjective. So it's like they say trans, it's not like I'm looking at a man. Like, it's like saying I'm looking at a white, the equivalent of saying I'm looking at a trans. Trans is not a noun. Trans is an adjective.
Yeah.
You're a trans man. You're a trans woman. So when they keep saying, you know, against trans people, they specifically mean that, but they don't even know enough to say that. They said a lot of these states that are putting these laws banning participation of trans people, specifically trans women, in girls' sports, we've never had a case that this was ever an issue. So they're implementing laws for problem that in some of those states has never even been something that's ever even brought it up.
Right.
But it's become a rallying cry. And why is it important now? Because you can no longer talk about segregating people based on their color.
Mm-hmm.
You can no longer easily attack someone being gay, even though there are states that are trying that. But culturally, there has been a momentum about gay and lesbian rights over the past 50 years. But trans people have always been kind of like the tail of that movement, even 30 years ago, even 40 years ago, even now. And I feel part of it is like the LGB movement, who wants to completely sever the LGB from the T part. To me, I think it's as simple as a pick me syndrome. Yeah. Like, I'm not those weirdos. I'm like you. I'm horrified by those people. So treat me as a friend and I will, you know, I will punch those people down. That's also true when you look at the ethnic demographics that voted Republican, the Iranians that voted. And, you know, it's not, in a way, it doesn't surprise me. It's just disappointing. But I think it's very much a human thing. I'm like, well, if I'm at the risk of being punched down, but if I can punch somebody else down and that will get the faith or the grace of my bully and keep me safe, then I'm going to do that.
Yeah, it's a lack of understanding and the use of fear. Like, I saw some of the ads that were being run in like Texas and Georgia and Oklahoma, and they were extremely not only stupid but very, very disturbing, just because it's like the rhetoric is like, this Democratic person wants to make your kid trans, and it's like, nobody is making anybody the way that they are. They are the way that they are. So they're, you know, like,
if that's how it worked, babe. Yeah. Only if that's how it worked.
No, I know. And I know that I'm more of like, I'm an idealist and I think everybody should just be who the fuck they are. But like, but that's not even like me being an idealist. That's just me being a human being. And like, there are lots of people just like me out there in the world. There's more of us than there are of them. I think that truly in my fucking heart.
Yeah. I believe that. It's just a matter of who's the loudest and who is willing to be the most violent. And I think it comes down to something as simple as that, because it's not even about understanding. I've done talks that I'm like, you know, in life, we accept many things that we don't understand. Why is it that we have to understand this particular thing before we can accept it?
Also, like, one of my uncles has no conceivability of outer space, and I'm not even kidding, but he still believes that outer space is a thing, right? So, like, yeah.
It's about many things. Do we see everything that happens in our bodies? No, but we accept it. I mean, the basis of religion is people accepting something they do not understand. So when someone tells me that, it's like, I'm like, no, you're this. I'm like, so let me get this right. You're willing to believe something that you can't see and say that is fact. But I am standing in front of you and telling you about my life experience and you're saying it's not valid. But then it's not truly about understanding. It's about, no, I don't want you in my periphery.
Yeah.
Because you make me uncomfortable. And somewhere in me, it thinks that maybe one of the things about trans people specifically that makes some people very uncomfortable, because we are this very outwardly obvious people who do not fit into very neat boxes. And that is seen as the audacity that I'm going to decide who I am. And that scares people, because I think on some level, that person looks at it and I'm like, well, if I live in this box that I don't necessarily love, but I live in it because I've been told and I don't have the courage to get out of it, then who the hell are you to have the audacity to not fit into a box that's been set for you?
I mean, yes. And I've had a lot of really hard and I guess interesting conversations with my friends who are gay. Not all of them, but specifically gay men that are older, like that are like in their late 50s, early 60s. And we have these conversations that are very troubling because it's very much like, well, I had to go through this in order to be who I am today. I had to suffer and suffer and suffer and suffer and get hit with bricks and sprayed with fire hoses. And now everyone has it so much easier now because of what I went through. And I'm like, it may be easier in certain ways and in some regards, but it has its own horrible things happening and immense challenges. And you paved the way for more people to be able to be out and open and free and not killing themselves because they can't be out.
I'll give you a simpler example. I'm an Iranian trans woman.
Yes.
Another Iranian trans woman, you know, beautiful. She does contests on all of them. So I post a lot about, you know, trans rights, specifically the ones affecting trans youth. And this person reached out to me and said, do you know why they're putting these laws in place? I mean, I didn't say, yes, I'm interested, but they proceeded to say, I'm like, it's because now everybody can wake up in the morning and say, I'm a woman.
Oh, I see.
I'm like, okay, where are we going with this? They're like, it's not like us, because you want it to be like, well, you and I, it's not like us that, you know, we've gone through this and we've gone through hormone therapy and we've done. I'm like, so we've been oppressed. So now we're not going to be happy until these other people are just as oppressed, because that will somehow make us feel better. And I understand that some people feel that way. It's like, if I suffered, so should you.
Yeah.
And that is someone's point of view, and everybody has a right to their point of view. I made a decision a long time ago, 20 something years ago. You know, trauma is like a meteor, and we're like a planet. That meteor hits you, and then you go in a particular direction based on that. When people receive trauma, they either go in this direction of, well, the world screwed me over, so now I'm going to make sure everybody else suffers.
Yeah.
Or the way that I have tried to take, I have suffered. I know what it's like to feel unsafe. I know what it's like to be filled with animosity towards myself, to not feel that I was able to have a full life like everybody else. Mm. And I'm here now. And I am here because I'm meant to. I have this kind of like a stupid idea about life. I think we're all little rings in this never-ending mesh of humanity. You know, it goes thousands of miles before us, and it will continue to go on until we blow ourselves off the face of the planet. And each one of us is just one ring, linked to another ring, linked to another one, sideways. And my job is to be the best friggin' ring that I can be and link what came before me and hand it off to the person after me.
Yeah.
Because for me, that is what gives me healing. When I get to talk to a young queer person who has a better way of expressing themselves than I did at their age, that doesn't make me feel insecure. That doesn't make me feel that, oh, no, I should punch this person down so they can start from the same place. Sure, can I have envy? Yeah, I wish that I had different teen years. But there's nothing, there's no amount of suffering I can inflict on anybody else that will make that change. I can try to be the best version of myself and be the kindest version of myself. My cat is agreeing with me back there. And that is how I find my healing. You know, is it too woo-woo? Maybe. I don't have a problem with being woo-woo. It has taken me from being a suicidal, insecure kid who tried to commit suicide over 10 times, who allowed myself to be in horrible situations, to now be here, that I do love who I am, that I have made my way here, that I am grateful for the strength and the luck and whatever it is that has allowed me to get here, and then share that with people who are not quite there and try to help them along. I see myself as somebody who's holding a little light that I have cultivated over the last 40-something years and just help a little those people who haven't quite found their path. Because other than that, like, what? I want to hold on to my misery to do what?
But that's why you're an artist, right? That's what artists do. I mean, you holding the light, as you just said, is a personal belief of mine too. What I've been through in my life and traumas and things of that nature, and it's why I'm an actor is for those same reasons. It's for people that were like me to be able to see a person like them doing something like this. It really is the most selfless thing that you can do, is to like give of yourself to other people. And I think that's beautiful, and that's a great analogy. The ring, like being part of, in my head, it was like chainmail armor. Like everyone,
it's exactly that.
Yeah,
and I will also say this. I'm not being selfless. I actually feel that I am very selfish, but I have to be at peace with my conscience.
Sure.
And my conscience feels healed when I feel that I have seen the cruelties of the world and I refuse to be part of the dark side. It's easy. But I'm selfish because I want to go to sleep with peace. And I'm okay with that. If my selfishness pushes me forward to try to do good, to try to put something better out there than what I had received, then yay. You know, we're not going to be here forever, but I always think about my life in the form of a legacy. But even more so, you as a comedian, you would understand this. I always look at my life from the point of view of, what do I want to see in my last moment of life, looking back on my life?
Sure.
And I always think, I want to look back and I want to laugh my ass off that I was audacious and I was sassy and I was gutsy and I tried to be my most authentic self every day that I could. And that helps me become the person that you see every day. Do I succeed every day? No, but if I get the chance to have also a tomorrow, then I try to do a little better that day, and so on and so forth. So I'm selfish, but I guess it comes out of selflessness. But by all means, be my PR campaign. Thank you.
No problem. No problem. I mean, but all that certainly translates in to your work, which is incredibly real and wonderfully grounded. And just a joy to watch, whether you're playing a judge on SVU or, you know, you're in a video game, you're able to just very realistically, I mean, just be who you are, and it shines through and it's beautiful. So Law and Order is kind of like you made it as a New York actor, like you got on SVU and you're a judge, which is great. You like weren't like one of the people that got murdered immediately, which is a plus, right?
Also, as a trans person of color, you know, a trans person of color to play a judge on such a staple in the Law and Order world, I felt like that was such a huge thing, not just for my journey, but for other people like me, that I got to be that in a position of authority. It meant a lot to me that I wasn't prostitute number three. Yeah, it was great.
Fantastic. Yeah, it really was. And what I I love the shift now where people are using, like, you are a trans woman, and that is literally like a point of pride. Like, this is who I am, and that's how it should be. And I love how now, like, TV and film in the world is like, our world is very much like, sick, yes, like, let's fucking go, like, let's amplify these people and these incredible voices in a way that hasn't happened before. And I'm just saying that I'm so happy that you're able to just do it. I mean, like, how has being a consultant been? Because you help others tell your own story, basically. So how does that work?
I mean, it's not just my story. How I have come in is usually, whether it's a feature film, I'm one of the writers for a new feature film that's being pitched. And, you know, that has been a journey. So I now actually say I'm one of the writers and not just the consultant. But it was when somebody would come to me and say, I have this story, I have this trans character, and I want to do right by this character. And then, you know, I would read through it. And, you know, I'm an actor, I'm also a writer, trans or not. And I would say, well, why did you write this character? And then when I get clarity on what their intention is then going into things of like, well, how can this character be best utilized without them being tokenized or marginalized or fetishized? And I've done that for a few feature scripts, for two short films that I co-produced, in numerous developments of new plays or new scripts. And this idea of, I mean, we've had this about female roles, that when you just have more female writers, the female characters come out slightly differently than when they're just written from a man's point of view. And it's no different. It's just, let these characters not just be a one-sided character from just the point of view that you're seeing them. How can we make them full characters while also honoring your story and the journey that you want these characters to take? And, you know, I mean, I've been in projects that, now looking back, I'm like, And I've also been in projects that I feel very proud of and feel very grateful to have been in it. And it's a joy to stand behind it and say, yes, I was in that. And yes, I won the, you know, whatever award for it. And, you know, it's not the first time that a minority group has been kind of like, whether it's that they're villains or victims or butt of jokes. African Americans for so many decades were portrayed as, you know, maids or drug dealers or whatever, until there came a time that there was enough momentum of people saying, no, this is no longer acceptable.
Yeah.
And I also wrote an article about that a few years ago. I called it the last days of trans face. And I said, well, there was a time people wore brown face and yellow face and black face. And there was a time that was acceptable. Well, we no longer find that acceptable. So why do we find it acceptable when somebody basically puts on a makeup and puts on a wig and it's essentially trans face, but somehow collectively we don't think that's a problem?
Oh yeah, like that movie. Did he win an Oscar for that movie?
The Danish Girl.
Yeah.
The Danish Girl kind of like happened at the cusp. I would say that at least they treated the story with love and care. I personally had a problem, and some people do have a problem, some people don't, that Eddie Redmayne played that character. But it's also, as some of the big producers in Hollywood have said, well, I have to put name actors in that, otherwise nobody would see it. But then the rebuttal to that is, but if you don't give opportunities to other actors, they will never become name actors. So this becomes just a self-fulfilling prophecy that you're never going to have minority big stars because you've never given them the opportunity to become that.
Yeah, that's just an issue, like, in general is a problem for, yeah. Like, it's like, why isn't there anyone new? It's because you won't let anyone new in. So, yeah.
And it keeps, it keeps justifying itself because it just keeps self-perpetuating.
It does, yeah. And they're like, look, it made all this money. See, it's because of this person.
Yeah.
And while maybe part of it may be part of that, a majority of the reason why a movie does well or like a TV show does well is because of the storytelling. And
hopefully.
The performance and all that stuff. Oh, weird. But that's not what is being seen or being pushed, but... Yeah. But
I think if you tell people a good story, even if it's not something they're familiar with or they're comfortable with, but you tell them a good story and you tell it truthfully and wholeheartedly, like you would tell any other story, because isn't that what we do? Don't we tell stories? Do we always tell people stories that they know? Why would we do that? We don't do that. But somehow in this particular thing, we're suddenly, no, we can just do these safe things. Whereas I think storytelling is a sacred calling because we do hold a mirror up to the worlds we live in, either showing its glory or its shortcomings on what the world can be. And I guess case in point is people who want the good old days, people who want an exclusive world, don't like new ideas to be presented because then that weakens the whole idea of the good old days.
Yeah. So, yes. So now you're about to be in The Walking Dead, which will be out next year. Yeah. And personally, I love the comics. I've been a fan of The Walking Dead forever. I love all the spin-off shows. So anytime anyone that I know is in it, I freak the fuck out. And when I found out that you were going to be in it, I went absolutely bananas. And I know that you're in the promo for it. Is there anything that you can say about it? Probably not, but maybe.
You know, I mean, what am I going to say? I play a matriarch of sorts. And I will say that the character was beautifully written and the storylines that I was part of, I loved it. I loved that I felt that I was part of the collaboration. And also, you know, when it got announced in Deadline and I was presented basically as the secondary cast of the second season, because at first I was like, okay, I'm a recurring guest star. I've done recurring guest star before, but this one just felt special.
Are you holding a heart in that promo? So you're holding something. It looks heart. It looks like an organ. Yeah, it's a heart. Yeah. Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to see what madness you are going to get up to.
I'll tell you this. Because, you know, I speak the way I do, which is very Upper East Side, kind of like, you know, bougie New Yorker. Because for so many years, it's like, I'm like, I'm a New Yorker. I'm like, I have to be clear. I sound more like a bougie New Yorker than just like, I'm like, hey, what's up? But one of the things that they were interested in, they really wanted my character to sound very New Yorker. And I don't get that opportunity very often. Yeah. So I'm very glad that, you know, I could kind of like lean into my, you know, a little more kind of like a down and dirty version of, you know, what supposed to do what.
Yeah.
It was a treat. It was, I was there for about a month shooting the multiple episodes. And when you see it, hopefully you will not be disappointed and you'll be pleasantly surprised.
I will not be at all disappointed. I'll be very excited. And so you, moving on to your next awesome thing, is you're about to make your Broadway debut in a show called English.
Yeah.
Which first ran off Broadway, right? at Playwrights Horizons.
At Atlantic Theatre Company.
At Atlantic Theatre Company. And now it's coming to?
Roundabout Theatre.
Thank you. What is this show about?
I also have to say, this is like one of those stories that I want young actors to take note of, because I'm about to make my Broadway debut, but the first time I came in contact with this play was 6.5 years ago, when it had its first public reading as Sanaz Tusi's, she's the playwright, as her thesis at NYU. That was the first reading. And then there was another stage reading at Roundabout Underground in, I believe, 2019. I think it was 2019. And then, you know, during the pandemic, it was going to have a production, and then, you know, it got pushed back. So what is it about? It's about an English class in the suburbs of Tehran. One teacher, four students. It's a TOEFL class. For those who don't know, TOEFL is teaching English as, what is it? Teaching of English as fluency. It has something fluency in language.
Okay.
So people do that because, in order to be able to get accepted into foreign universities, you need to have a certificate of your English fluency. And this is kind of like, you know, the international mark of like, okay, you kind of like, you know, pass these basic qualifications language-wise. And so the four characters, each of them are learning English for different reasons. My character, I play a grandmother, a young, well-preserved grandmother.
Yes, yes.
You know, I want that to be remembered. That I have also, you know, played it before. And she wants to connect with her son and her very young grandchild. And that's why she's in this class, not because she necessarily wants to take the test, but because she wants to kind of like up her fluency. And that's what it is on the surface. Deeper, it kind of like addresses the Anglocentricity of the world that we live in. And what happens when you're not in the in-group and you have an accent that is not considered desirable? How do people perceive you based on that accent? When you're learning this accent to leave your home behind, how much of yourself do you take with you? How much of you do you have to leave behind to be able to acclimate in this new world? And obviously, it's not just my opinion. You know, it won the Lucille Lortel Award. It won the Drama Desk Award. It won Obies. We all won Obies for it. And then it won the Pulitzer. So by all accounts, it's a great play, and I've done it multiple times, playing different roles. To me, it feels very personal because I feel, first of all, it's the first Iranian play on Broadway.
Yeah, that's a huge deal.
Yeah, you know, and that I get to play a woman who in some way resembles my mother and my grandmother. And I get to embody this woman and tell her story. Whereas before, nobody knew the story of these women, their joys, their regrets, their resentment, their insecurities and their desires. And to get to now do it on Broadway, at Roundabout Theater Company, which is one of the most prestigious theaters in New York.
Yep.
And for me to have had the journey of basically being kicked out of the business 20-something years ago, to now get to play this fabulous character on Broadway in front of thousands of people, I'm very grateful.
It's I am so happy that you are getting to do this. It is for me to watch you go where you are going and to do the things that you have done and to be in this specific show right now in this moment when it's opening, is a huge cultural boon, I feel, for everyone that will see it, everyone that will even hear about it. It is a thing that is super, super important and incredibly relevant. And I'm so fucking happy for you. Yeah, you're welcome. It's, you're welcome. It's I just I when y the people that you respect and care about are winning, you're winning too. You're, you know, like it's just
It's your people, you know, it's your
joy.
ilk.
Yeah, it's joyful. Like, yeah, and I can't wait to see you in it.
Thank you. It's you know, I think one of the, I mean, aside from me, is the fact that I get to share my opening night in this with my mom, which
Oh, wow.
just means a lot to me because, you know, my mom was an English teacher. That's how I learned to speak English from such a young age. It's my mom who decided that in order for me to survive, that she needed to leave her home behind in her late 40s and come and get a master's here at 50. And so now, 20 something years later, to get to have an opening on Broadway in this fabulous play, kind of like on its glorious return back to New York, and to share that night. I also love with my mom. It's like I was like, you know, mom, opening night is a crazy night because everybody wants my attention and everybody wants to talk to me. I won't get, be able to get to talk to you. My mom is so my mom. She's like, I'm not a child. I don't need you to look after me. I don't need to talk to you. I just want to be there. You go talk to other people.
That's awesome.
I'm like, okay, mom.
This is a really great comment, actually. So many people are precluded from seeing themselves reflected in art and the wider scope, and the wider the scope becomes, the more beautiful it is. And that's absolutely true. Especially with this material, like I just because of that section of the world, especially in America, and we were speaking about it earlier, even just the prejudice and the pretense and the ideas of what people are like from there are hardly ever represented in American art in a positive way. And this is going to show people something completely different.
It's like you said, it's a cultural moment.
Cultural moment, yeah.
You know, the first Iranian American playwright to win a Pulitzer for her play. And that I'm she's like my younger sister. I'm proud of her. I'm grateful to have been part of this journey with her. But I feel that's kind of where I get my energy, that I feel when I see my younger sister getting a Pulitzer, like you said, you know, it's like your tribe, you know, when she's winning, when I see a friend of mine, you know, Brian Michael Smith.
Oh, yeah, Brian Michael
And I
Smith.
think, you know, our friend, you know, it's like he when he became a series regular on the new L Word and then 911 Lone Star, it's I'm proud. It's like, I'm like, that's my friend
Yeah.
who deserves it, who's an amazing person, who's talented. And to get to do that and you cheer them, you know, like, I guess it's kind of like, sure, we all want to have our breaks, but when your circles go up, I feel like we all go up because it's
Oh,
your
true.
circles that's moving up.
Yeah, it's true. We're over an hour, which is great. but so if anyone has any questions or comments, I don't care if you have any concerns. I don't care. But please ask them now or make comments now. When will English be opening?
We're in rehearsal now. So no holiday season for me. We're going all the way through. We have tech next week. Our previews start on January 3rd. Our official opening, you know, the big brouhaha on Broadway. That's going to be, I believe, January 25th or January 26th. But our first preview is January 3rd. And it's a limited run. It's only, as of now, we are going to have 66 performances.
Great. So you better get there. You better see it, because I hear it's really good.
People tell me.
People are telling me right now that it's incredible. So go see this show. Look out for Puya on The Walking Dead next year. Thank you so much for being here.
I remember a few years ago you and I did a reading, and then I sent you an email the following day thanking you for creating space. And then it took you a few days to get back to me. You're like, I took a few days because I just didn't know what to say. Yeah. And I'm a believer that when people do kind things, we should tell them. Because the same way that when somebody does something bad, we should tell them, we should also say, Joshua, thank you. Thank you for creating that space. Thank you for writing a character that it was a joy for me to read. And when people say, well, the world is tough, I'm like, well, who is the world made of, if not us? Is it just easier to just say it's a cruel world so we don't have to have responsibility? Because, well, then the world is just going to be the shit that it's been for as long as we've known it. Whereas if we actually want to take responsibility, I always invite my friends, my fans, my community, know that you have the ability to change the world around you, even if it's just a tiny, 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 tiny bit.
Yeah.
But remember, that butterfly effect is real. You do something tiny that's small, and then that inspires somebody else. Something, and this will be the last thing I say. When I used to be affiliated with Gender and Family Project, one of their fundraisers has said, the voice of hate has always been there. And it's always been loud. I mean, it's changed flavor through the years, but it's always been there for as long as there have been people. And yeah. Nobody can deny that fact. What I'm trying to do is to raise the voice of kindness and inclusion and humanity. If that means it's just me screaming it from, I don't know, some bucket on the corner of 42nd Street, then so be it. But I invite everyone to believe that you all have the ability to make the world better. All of us in different capacities, but we all have that ability.
It's true. We actually got a question, Puya.
Oh.
Boom. What was the hardest part about bringing this play to life? Is it such a labor of love and so personal, but was there any moment where you felt it kind of slipping away?
Well, you know, I've been in development of many plays, and no one sets out to write something bad, but it's just, you know, the little things. When is it being written? Kind of like catching the zeitgeist, being at the right moment and all of that. And this play has changed a lot since this first reading 6 years ago.
I'm sure, yeah.
But I can tell you one thing, though. When it was scheduled to make its off-Broadway debut almost 3 years ago, and we were in rehearsal room, actually, funny enough, the same rehearsal rooms that we're in now. And I think the week before we were about to have previews, I remember thinking, I'm like, is anybody going to come and see this show? Who's the audience? Is there an audience? And it wasn't until the first preview that we're like, we have a show. So were there moments, you know, I mean, like, who am I? I'm just one of the actors in it that I feel very connected to it. But I can tell you, every actor in this play feels very connected to it because it's the same group. It's the same entire creative team as when we debuted off Broadway 3 years ago. We all feel connected to it and connected to each other. There is love, and the desire to tell this story as best as we can, because we want to make sure these characters that we're putting in front of you, these characters are truthful. These characters have agency. These characters are real, because these characters mean something to all of us. For me, it's this particular character. For the other characters, and you know, when the pandemic happened, like many other people, is it going to happen? Is it not going to happen? But here we are, 3 years after its off-Broadway debut, and it goes back to what I said earlier about my life is, you have to believe in something, and then you will figure out how.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And my life, you know, the little bit that the people who've been watching this know about it, obviously you can Google more, but me being here talking to you now is the exact embodiment of that philosophy. You have to believe it against all odds. It's almost like you're in absolute dark, but you have to be able to see the light, to seek it. First, you have to see it here to then try to seek it out here.
Yeah. That's fucking, yeah. I don't have anything to add to that for you. That is the embodiment of moving forward in a positive way. It's the belief that it can and will happen is the thing.
And that gives you resilience. That gives you resilience, because if you have the fear, and look at every person who has ever succeeded, that doesn't mean we don't have fear. By all means, please don't think that I mean that I don't have fear. We don't all have fear. We have fear. We just don't let the fear control our actions.
Yeah, you just keep going. You just keep going no matter what.
Yes.
Well, Pooya, thank you again so much for asking me. Yeah, this was a great conversation. It went all over the place. And that's my favorite part of having this live show, is that we can just fucking talk about anything, which is great.
I do hope, and I'm going to put it out there so the world knows, I do hope you and I get to work together again.
Sometime. I really want to work together again. I have a role written for you in that movie that you read. And, you know, I'm still pitching it, and it's lost funding, it's gained funding, it's lost funding. But if not in that, then yeah, let's fucking work together again. Let's do it.
Here's the faith and the belief, and we put it out there, and we'll see what form it takes.
Yeah, we are definitely going to work together.
Yes. It's going to happen.
All right.
Thank you for having me, my friend. Thank you all for watching.
Thank you, everybody. And I will speak to you soon, Pooya, okay? Bye. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for being here this evening. We ran over, but I think it was worth it. This was a great conversation. I just love Pooya so much. Ever since I met her all those years and years ago. Not that we're old, but it was over 10 years ago. Again, we are sponsored by, let me get the graphic. Oh, Josh, you weren't prepared. By Lucas Roasting Company, you get 15% off using the promo code the live stream live. The link is in underneath all these videos, or it's in my bio on Instagram. I also have a subscription membership that costs less than one cup of coffee a month, where you get access to everything that I've ever made and my innermost thoughts and stupid things that I'm working on. I have merch. I have lots of other links that you can check out also underneath the video and in the link in my bio on Instagram. If you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe. Thank you so much for being here, and I'll see you next time on the live stream live. Good night, everybody.